Bin Laden was George Sr.'s clan not so long ago. Set George up with a retirement plan, lots of low tax dough. Go down White House, way down in payoff land. Tell the CIA, leave the Saudis alone. There's oil and gas in Uzbekistan. Oil and gas must flow. So we depose the Taliban. Where'd Osama go? Bend down, Congress. Kneel down and lend a hand. Tell the people liberty must go. There's more to gain in war than peace. Let the weapons flow. Destabilize the Middle East. Enrich the CEO. Go down, brother, way down on Florida sand. Tell the justices not to let my people vote. The VP had a heart attack, oily blood, you know. While he's still here, let's bomb Iraq, give the rubes a show. Lie down, people, lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go. The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow. Thanks to U.S. troops, it's back today. Only goes to show. Go down Wall Street, sell off my shares today. Tell my broker, put it all in blow.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at axissacramento.org. Or you can hear this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Facing Disaster in the Middle East with Stephen Kinzer. American and European policies in the Middle East have produced a region immersed in violence, terror, anger, and oppression. The West needs to change policies that were shaped for the Cold War. Kinzer offers ideas for a better approach to the world's most turbulent region. And then after that, toxic lead still in brass plumbing. Officials at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill tested water coming from new brass plumbing in some of the college's new buildings and found it contains high levels of lead.
Americans are not good at facing unpleasant realities. We are hardwired, and I think this goes with neurological research. We're hardwired to want to see things in patterns that we understand. And when events violate the patterns we have in our minds, we try to deny them or transform them. Hamas is now in trouble in Gaza from more radical groups that are saying, You're selling us out because you're not bombing Israel every day. Why are you being collaborationist? This is exactly the impulse that led to the emergence of Hamas in the first place. Now, if we think Hamas is too radical to deal with, imagine we get to the point where Hamas becomes the new Fatah, and you get another group coming out of this. This is inevitably going to happen. And when I say Israel is careening towards self-destruction, and taking steps that in the long run are undermining the regional stability that is its only guarantee of long-term safety, I'm referring above all to its projects in Gaza and the West Bank. It has to do with the pathologies of American politics and the refusal of the United States to separate its own interest, not from the interest of Israel, but from the interest of the group that has now been produced by the current electorate in Israel. And as I don't want to repeat what I said earlier, but I do think that as politics in America evolve and as the economic challenges America faces intensify, there is going to be intensifying pressure to reevaluate our role in the world. And ultimately, this is going to have to include confronting the distorted nature of the U.S.-Israel relationship. It won't happen soon enough, but I think it will happen.
Yes.
Hi, Angus McSwan from Reuters. Looking at the bad options, I wonder what you thought the probability of a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities would be in the next, say, 12 months, particularly a unilateral Israeli action.
I don't believe there's a prospect of violent action against Iran, a bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities anytime in the next year or two or probably three. I now see just within the last week that the outgoing head of the Israeli security agency has said that now they estimate the time when Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon is further in the future than they thought. It has been now 2 decades since Israel has been asserting that Iran is either 2 or 3 years away from having a nuclear weapon. Some of that may have been true, and Israel is undoubtedly behind a lot of the reason why Iran hasn't gotten there yet. I think this should be an urgent challenge for the U.S. to try to make sure this doesn't happen. I don't want any more countries to be nuclear armed. Nonetheless, we are not acting with the urgency that one would expect if we consider this problem to be as imminent as we think. Let me just add this. When I was in Israel doing research for my book, Reset, I had the chance to attend a very small, strictly off the record, which I'm going to try not to violate, dinner with a very high official of the Israeli government in charge of intelligence. And he gave kind of a tour d'horizon of how Israel sees the world. About half of that was about Iran. And here's the thing he said that really stuck in my mind. He said, all of you, there were only about 20 of us in the room, about half from other countries. He said, you're all reading in your newspapers about how Israel is terrified of Iran getting a nuclear weapon because the first thing they're going to do when they get one is they're going to bomb us and we'll all be dead. I say, that's half right. We are very worried about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, but not for that reason. In fact, none of us in our security establishment really believes that Iran would ever use its nuclear weapon against Israel, because this would mean the liquidation from the face of the earth of Iran in the space of minutes, and the Iranians would realize this and would never do that. Now, we are against Iran getting a nuclear weapon for two other reasons. One is we're afraid it's going to set off a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And then the Turks and the Saudis and the Egyptians will all want to get into this, and we really are in trouble. But secondly, when you have a nuclear weapon, you don't have to use it. Just having it gives you great power to intimidate your neighbors. Nobody would know this better than Israel itself. So I think there is this intensity of fear in Israel. Nonetheless, in the political establishment, there isn't the sense of imminent doom that Israel is happy to allow the outside world to believe exists. In the long run, one of the bad things that's going to happen in the world in the 21st century is there are going to be more nuclear powers. This is bad for everybody. Unfortunately, it's a challenge for all governments in the world to have to learn how to deal with this situation, not to accept it. And I think it should be a fundamental principle of Western diplomacy to try to be sure that Iran does not join this club. Nonetheless, other countries are going to join that. And As with global warming, it's not something we're going to be able fully to prevent, so we ought to be devoting some of our efforts to thinking about how do we deal with it when it happens.
Okay, there's four more questions, so I'd like you to keep them brief, please. And...
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Leo. No? Okay. At the back, I'm confused.
Yes, hello. You've said a lot about why the United States should change its policies and why it'd be in the interest of the United States to do so. My question is, why would it be in the interest of the current Iranian regime to change its policies, which is a regime which is fairly paranoid, is concerned about how long it will last in Iran, and has used anti-Americanism from the start as a pledge of allegiance of sorts. And it's easy if a politician in Iran wanted to have an opening with the U.S., people in the political establishment could try and paint him as a traitor, as being working against the Islamic Republic, and so on and so forth. And I want to know how you can see that can happen in the short term, not just in the long term. Thank you.
Certainly there are officials in Iran who seem to be deeply emotionally attached to the anti-American project. I don't think necessarily Ahmadinejad is one of them, but he may not be the final decision maker. I think that what Iran wants more than anything is what the Soviets wanted from the Helsinki Accord, which is security guarantees. They are very nervous. They are very insecure. We do have something to offer them. This would also be a way for Iran to outflank some of its enemies and consolidate its role as an important power in the Middle East. In addition, this is it's an increasingly unpopular regime. This would be a step that could dramatically increase its popularity. And let me say one thing about the Green Movement that emerged after the last election that became very clear to me when I was there in my last visit in May. This movement is in a bad situation. It has no good options. But the best of the bad options for the Green Movement would be if the regime could somehow be lured out of its isolation and out of its paranoia. The U.S. has something to offer Iran, and if Iran can get over its emotions, we should be able to do that too.
There was a question here in the front. Am I wrong? Yes. So the man in the purple there, please, in the middle. And then Simon.
Hi. I was just wondering, just my question was similar to the one just asked, but you mentioned the anti-Western and the anti-American rhetoric among Iranian politicians as emotions, but they seem to be using it. They've been using it forever since 30 years ago to win the limited legitimacy that they have domestically and internationally. So how would you see that? Would you agree with that? And how would you see that transform?
I would agree with it, but I think that the legitimacy this government enjoys internationally and domestically is steadily eroding. And I can't put myself in their mindset, but some people in the Iranian leadership must be thinking, we need to do something to break out of a dangerous slide for us. I think that's what Americans should also be thinking. So I don't rule out the possibility that you could get this kind of evolution on both sides.
I have a question going back to the pathologies of U.S. foreign policy, and it is, how quickly is the United States intelligentsia or the research community in this, going forward in this self-diagnosis, if you want? So I think it was in 2006, there was the book by Mersheimer and Walt on the Israel lobby. There are more voices criticizing the straitjacket which you have described, and there's your book. So how do you see the situation in the United States today? What is happening, and where is it happening in think tanks, universities, newspapers?
I think there is a slow evolution about views on Israel, and it's driven principally by Gaza and the settlement project. It's not anti-Israel, but I think there's a growing disquiet, incidentally led by American Jews, over the intensity of this project. Ultimately, this also is fomenting global anti-Semitism, and that is the real long-term danger So in the long run, I think when people, including American Jews, are thinking about this, that is contributing to what I think is a changing dynamic in certain segments of the American foreign policy community and the larger chattering class. I'll tell you this, just to give you one story. I gave a talk about this book, Reset, in Washington some weeks ago. And a guy came up to me afterward who works in the White House in the national security team. And this is what he said to me. One thing you said we probably would all agree with in the White House, and that is that our policy in the Middle East isn't working. We need something new. What we haven't figured out is two things. First of all, what would that new policy be? And I've tried to lay out my ideas for that. And secondly, how could we sell that to the American electorate? That's the problem that's next on the agenda.
Okay. Last question.
Taghi Amirani, Iranian filmmaker. How credible or believable is the notion that the United States is courting and grooming the Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi, as a kind of Ahmad Shalabi figure? And what do we think about the Republicans meeting with MKO in Paris in order to kind of lift the terrorist label?
I find it very disquieting that there are attempts, very unusual in American politics, by one political party to go abroad and meet with groups, particularly in this case, a group that is on the State Department terrorist list, and try to recruit it into our political project. This is exactly what I mean when I say, whatever the U.S. does, we should not do anything now that is going to make it more difficult for us to make an accord with Iran when the time comes. Allying ourselves with a group that fought alongside Saddam Hussein against Iran is not going to win us any friends in Iran. It'll be very hard for us to erode our position in public opinion in Iran, but this would be one way to do it. And as for the future of the Pahlavi heir, I really have a hard time envisioning a scenario in which Iranians would welcome a return of the monarchy. The only hope that I think the Pahlavis harbor, and it is also harbored by their small group of remaining supporters, is that things have gone so badly in Iran since the Pahlavis left that enough people will have forgotten the sins of the Pahlavis and will think maybe they weren't so bad after all. I don't see this as a very powerful argument. Just to say that we should put someone in power because they weren't as bad as the Mullah regime does not seem very appealing to me. So I see that family with the tragedies that it's that is now facing, not to mention the tragedies that it was responsible for in Iran, having a nice long-term future in Arlington, Virginia, where Prince Reza lives, and I don't see it extending to Iran anytime soon.
That was Facing Disaster in the Middle East with Stephen Kinzer. And coming up next, toxic lead still in brass plumbing.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman. Officials at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill recently discovered something disturbing. The water coming out of dozens of brand new water coolers in their brand new building on campus had dangerously high levels of lead. It didn't make sense. Lead's a potent neurotoxin that was banned from pipes and solder used in plumbing decades ago. So where was the lead coming from? Mark Edwards, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech, was called in to investigate. Professor Edwards, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you for having me.
So where was the lead coming from?
Well, the only source of lead left in new construction has to do with brass fixtures, and these include your faucet at the kitchen, and also intricate plumbing devices such as ball valves and water meters that are used on the path as the water flows to your tap.
And how did they discover the problem?
Initially, some of the students and faculty in the building had complaints about the taste and odor of the drinking water, and when they went to investigate, they were shocked to find that about 20% of the samples that they tested were over federal standards for lead.
Brass, if I'm not mistaken, is a combination of copper and zinc, right?
Correct, but lead is added to improve the machinability of the brass material, and Congress, in its wisdom, while it banned lead pipes and lead and solder, they chose under the Safe Drinking Water Act to define lead-free brass as anything that contains up to 8% lead by weight. So even to this day, it's still perfectly legal to install brass that weighs 8% lead in brand new buildings.
So this lead was leaching out of the brass fitting?
That's correct. In some cases, the brass leaches much, much more than in others, depending on the device and the specific alloy.
So my guess, these water coolers weren't the only ones to have this problem.
Oh, by no means. We have sampled in several new schools around the country and have found, even in elementary schools, brand new buildings, a disturbing percentage of the lead collected from the taps over federal guidelines.
Oh, that's trouble because kids are particularly susceptible to the neurotoxin lead.
That's correct, and that's why this is such a concern.
So what's your guesstimate in terms of how widespread this problem is?
Well, we really don't know because right now no one's requiring testing. What makes the situation at UNC Chapel Hill so unusual is they had very conscientious administrators who adopted a zero-tolerance policy. And it's only because of this policy that we detected these problems. In most cases, people just assume that the water's safe.
Now, these brass fittings, they met the federal standard.
Yes, they did, and that's what makes this so disconcerting. What we discovered was on the surface that contacted the water, we found lead levels as high as 18 to 20% by weight. So it legally met the under 8% standard of the U.S. Congress, but practically it was as if these devices contained 18 to 20% lead.
So lax standards and lax inspection and oversight then?
Well, yes, there's another standard, a performance standard that these devices are supposed to pass that is designed to ensure that they should never leach lead at levels that constitute a health threat. But about 5 years ago or so, we discovered that these tests, under the guise of the National Sanitation Foundation, were so lax that it was akin to doing crash testing of cars into a wall of pillows. We showed that pure lead devices could pass the standard, and so passing the test meant nothing whatsoever in terms of how they'd actually perform. And so what we saw in UNC was a very clear and dramatic example of our earlier concerns that devices were being certified as safe when they were anything but.
So in your expert opinion and experience, what needs to be done?
Well, there's currently a law sponsored by the Environment Public Works Committee of the U.S. Senate that will define lead-free as something far, far less than 8% lead in the device that's legally allowed. There's discussion of only allowing 0.025% lead in surfaces that contact the water. And if we had that standard, we would no longer have these problems, and in a new building we could assume that the water is safe from elevated lead.
Just this past weekend, I put in a new faucet in one of my bathrooms, and should I be worried?
Well, it's quite common that for a period of time, it could last anywhere from a week to a month or so, that the lead is elevated when you install a new faucet in your bathroom or kitchen. What made this most recent case so unusual is that the high lead persisted at levels 20, 30 times the federal standards for months and months and months, and no matter how hard we tried to fix the problem, we couldn't until we went in and found this one particular device and eventually removed it.
Well, what can I do, or what can anyone do at home if they have this problem? How would they even know they have the problem?
Well, that's what makes it so difficult. It might only affect 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1,000 taps with very, very serious problems. But they're extraordinarily difficult to remediate because once this plumbing is installed, and of course it's behind walls and in crawl spaces, even knowing that the problem existed, it took us $30,000 of staff time and effort to find this defective device and remove it from the system so it could no longer pose a danger to public health. So I don't have the answer right now, but the first step is to recognize that these problems can and do exist, and we should be alert to them.
Well, Professor Edwards, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Mark Edwards teaches at Virginia Tech. He and Carolyn Elflin from UNC Chapel Hill solved the mystery of the campus water coolers. Their findings are in the latest issue of the Journal of the American Water Works Association, and there's a link to the study on our website, loe.org.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
That's all, folks.